Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. We'll come to order now. Thank you. It is 1:35 in the afternoon of Friday, April 17th, 2009. This is the last Judiciary Committee meeting of this year. I want to thank the members, and you're all, we're glad to see you all here, but this will be our final meeting. We have a lot of ground to cover, and we all have tight schedules this time of year, so we'll go ahead and get started. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. The first bill up is HB 101 by Representative Coghill. He has someone from his office here to present the bill. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your presentation.
My name is Amanda Mortensen, staff to Representative Coghill, and I'm here with HB 101, which exempts the full value of life insurance and annuities from being attached to by creditors in the case of liability. This bill would protect Alaskan families and their ability to plan for their future. For example, if person A was to hit person B with a car, person B could sue for the assets of person A. This bill would protect person A's life insurance and annuity contracts so that their family can still survive on their own. It does not prevent person B from being able to garnish person A's other assets in order to fulfill the settlement. It also protects the death benefit of a spouse or a dependent of the debtor in the case that the person is not yet deceased. Currently, retirement plans are creditor protected under federal laws. This bill would help if an employee was working for an employer who did not offer a retirement plan. The employee could use an annuity as a retirement plan and provide themselves and their families with better financial security. With the uncertainty of the Social Security system, Alaskan families need to be able to legitimately plan for their future. This bill falls under Title 38, the Alaska Exemptions Act. It then falls under Section 15, Property Exempt Without Limitation. Section 1 adds unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts owned by the individual to the list of property exempt without limitation.
Ms. Mortensen, hang on 1 second while I recognize and welcome to the committee Senator Terry, who came in just a minute or so ago. Please proceed.
Thank you. Section 2 removes the words or payable in order to clarify a potential ambiguity regarding trying to garnish a death benefit on an individual who has not passed away yet. Section 3 is repealed because there is no longer any reason to have a section dedicated to the exemption of unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts, since they now fall under the category of property exempt without limitation. Section 4 is an applicability section that states that this will only apply to a debt that is created on or after the effective date of this act. And as of May 2007, 10 states exempt life insurance and annuities 100% from creditors. And on the line, I have Linda Hulbert from New York Life Insurance, and I also have Dennis Bailey from Legislative Legal if there are any legal questions. Thank you.
Questions for the bill's sponsor's representative.
Yeah.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but so let's just assume someone had $100,000 in unpaid child support payments, and there was they got a big life insurance policy, $1 million. Would you be able to take that out under this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, Section 093865 is titled Claims Enforceable Against Exempt Property, and A is child support. So child support is something that can be garnished from exempt property.
And can you maybe tick off a couple of some of the other things that are exempt so that wouldn't be covered by this bill that you could garnish? Is there a list?
Yes, there's a list under that section. It says child support, unpaid earnings of up to 1 month's compensation or the full-time equivalent of 1 month's compensation for personal services of an employee, state or local taxes, and a creditor may make a levy against exempt property to enforce a claim for the purchase price of the property or a loan made for the express purpose of enabling an individual to purchase the property and used for that purpose, labor or materials furnished to make, repair, improve, preserve, store, or transport the property, and a special assessment imposed to defray costs of a public improvement benefiting the property. That looks like it's, there's the list continues.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Actually, I have a follow-up question. This time of year, my brain works really slowly. And so I think you probably understand the bill 10 times better than the rest of us do. And so I just need to ask to rephrase Senator Wilkowski's question. His question was about whether, in the event of the death of an individual with a huge unpaid child support obligation, whether an annuity contract could be garnished to pay that. And what was the answer, yes or no?
That, Chairman, that the statutes say that claims enforceable against exempt property. I would maybe ask Linda Holbert about the death benefit part of that. I'm not an insurance expert, but she is, so.
I understand. We can refer those brain teasers to the people that have been working in this area for a long time. Let me ask a more generic question. You've presented this bill, I assume, in other committees and along the way. Has there been any opposition to the bill?
Chairman, really there hasn't been that much opposition. Most people see it as a benefit for Alaskan families to provide for their future. There really hasn't been a big opposition.
Yeah, and I feel warmly towards the bill. I like the general idea. Although, just speaking off the top of my head, as I look through the items that are exempted, they seem fairly, and I guess they seem fairly small. You know, a burial plot, that's fairly small. A health aid reasonably necessary to enable the individual to work or sustain health, that seems fairly concrete. A liquor license, I'm not sure why that's in there. That seems like something that maybe the char industry won a long time ago, and they probably not. Rather, we didn't delve into it, and it's not part of your bill, so I won't go there. But you know, number 9 is a permanent fund dividend. These are all fairly concrete. Oh, and I should ask what are just above the segment of your bill? There's a benefits paid or payable under 4745.301-309. What are those? Do you know?
Chairman, I'm sorry, I do not know that. I could get you that answer, or maybe Dennis.
We can look up the statute, or we'll ask Mr. Bailey.
He would be the one.
And I, as I was walking through this, I guess I was just sort of arriving at a point that said, this, as Senator Wilikowski and his question suggested, could be a rather huge amount of money. I don't know how big an annuity contract could be, but it just seems like one thing we may think about is imposing some upper limit on that. Because as much as I want to look after the consumers of the world, and I tend to fall on that side of the scale, there are also the creditors, who may have loaned this person $1 million based on the strength of this contract, and then suddenly, poof, they can't collect. So further questions or comments, Senator Wilikowski? Yeah.
Just a couple follow-ups. Number one was, you said there wasn't that much opposition. Was there any opposition?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there really wasn't any opposition. Some people had the same concerns about just the possibility of someone using this fraudulently. And it has been proven in other states that when taken to court, they have been ruled against, saying it was considered a fraudulent transfer and they were not allowed to hide the money as they were intending to do. So really that's been the only opposition, has been fears, but it has been proven that they have not in other states.
Has anyone testified against the bill?
No, sir, okay. Through the chair. Okay.
And then, if I could, Mr. Chair, if someone took out a loan and used their life insurance policy as collateral, let's say, then in that situation, I would assume that they could collect the life insurance policy?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm not going to say yes or no. That would be a question for Linda Holbert. She would definitely be able to answer that for you.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Terry, did you have a question?
No.
Senator McGuire.
Okay. And through the chair, and maybe Linda Holbert knows the answer, but you might. Typically, at least in bankruptcy proceedings, the question of timing arises, so that and it goes back to what you were saying in terms of attempts to hide assets. So I'm just wondering if in the bill we need some sort of language that gives it's an unmatured life insurance or annuity contract owned by the individual, but it doesn't give any indication as to when that life insurance policy or annuity contract was entered into. And so my only question would be, if it was a clear, attempt to hide assets to be sheltered under this provision, perhaps we'd want to exclude that. And maybe that's a question for Linda.
Do you want to take a stab at that, or?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I would say either Linda Holbert could talk about that, or Dennis Bailey may be able to tell you if there's other statutes that already have a day limitation.
Mr. Chairman, there may be a superseding provision of law that just generally prohibits fraud. We can find out. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would come under the fraudulent transfer. That's where they would, I would assume, have set the timing mechanism. whether this transfer or any transfer was done, I think would be spoken to under the fraudulent transfer provisions.
Further questions for Ms. Mortensen? I don't see any. Thanks so much for your presentation. Let's turn to Linda Hulbert, who is on the line from Fairbanks. Ms. Hulbert, can you hear me?
I certainly can. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. State your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much, Senator French. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Linda Hulbert. I've lived in Fairbanks for 40 years, 20 years as an adult educator, and the last 20 years as an associate with New York Life Insurance Company. I've lived here a long time, and I've worked with many, many Alaska families. I would like to testify in support of this bill. I find that it's very, very important to do. We have a changing environment. People need to assume more responsibility for themselves today. Employers are assuming less and less responsibility. People need to plan for the well-being of their families should something happen to them. And people need to plan for their own retirements today. We need the advantage that House Bill 101 offers to us. It offers to us the same opportunities that the states of New York and Maryland, Texas and Florida, Wyoming, Kansas, and most recently Arizona have all provided for their residents, which is stated as this bill states, the protection of life insurance and annuities for planning. There is a very specific and carefully crafted Fraudulent Transfers Act. So anyone who would enter into this in any fashion where it would remotely be near the fraudulent transfer, it would not be considered asset protected. So those are very carefully defined and very carefully crafted. And many of you remember those because they were related to in the Alaska Trust Act series of legislation. So the fraudulent transfer is very clearly defined by our court system. So if you tried to fraudulently use this, that certainly would not be an item that would work. I would like to address one other item, which is the collateral assignment. Anyone can collaterally assign a life insurance policy or an annuity contract. Should they do so, the creditor comes first before anything is paid to the individual or the beneficiary. So this clearly does not create a problem with creditors because creditors can ask for collateral assignments and get them. So this doesn't mean that it can't be used to pledge against a loan of any sort. It simply means that if a family enters into a planning process and they do it legitimately, that they can be rest assured that for either retirement purposes or purposes of taking care of their loved ones after they're gone, that this is protected for them. And I think this is a critical planning tool to have. And I've been working with Representative Coghill and other legislators on this. We have not had any testimony that I am aware of against the bill. We have had questions, as Amanda related, about fraudulent transfers. We had concerns about this being abused. I think this is very unlikely to be abused because of the careful protections that our state has structured. It's not for people who are really wealthy. If you're really wealthy, you have lots of other things you can do to protect your money. This is for a majority of Alaska citizens who just want to accept responsibility for their own planning process and need some protections for that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. I don't want to use up any more time. I know you've got a heavy agenda today.
Ms. Hulbert, thank you for your brevity and for your good remarks. I have a question, and Senator Wilikowski has a question. Just for the record, what is an unmatured life insurance contract as opposed to a matured one?
A matured one is when you die, an unmatured one was when you haven't died yet.
Thank you. And a follow-up question for me is, have other states, when they enact a law such as this, imposed an upper limit to the amount of the exemption, you know, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million?
No, they have not.
Thank you.
And I will step back one state and say that I talked with our division of the Director of Insurance, Linda Hall, about this. Originally, we were going to draft the bill just for insurance, and she indicated that she supported and thought we should use it both for insurance and annuities because they were good, sound planning techniques to use, and because a lot of other very responsible states had set this forward and hadn't had any difficulty with it.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would help me a little bit if I had some kind of an idea of what sort of debts we're referring to that we're exempting people from. Could you give me a couple examples?
I guess I'm having a hard time, Senator Rilikowski, through the chair, answering this question. I think that perhaps if there was a car accident and you were sued and it went beyond the limits of your insurance, you could take other people's assets, but you couldn't take their defined benefit plan, their retirement plan, because that's federally protected. But if you didn't have access to a federally defined retirement plan and you had an annuity, then you could take that person's potential annuity, whereas this way, if they'd set aside money for retirement, it would be protected like their 401k or their defined benefit would be. Well, it would be something unexpected, not something planned.
So other than lawsuit, are there other things that you can, other sorts of debts that would be exempt, that we'd be exempting people from, that you can?
I think we would probably have to address, I would feel more comfortable if we would have an attorney address that. I have not run into that circumstance, no. I just feel like people feel more secure having this law passed and knowing that they could plan. And I apologize, I'm just a lay person who deals with Alaska families all the time and not an attorney. Is there some way that we could answer that with legal information?
We've got one. This is Senator French, Ms. Hulbert. We've got Dennis Bailey from Ledge Legal on the line.
Okay.
Further questions for Ms. Hulbert? Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Linda, could you answer the question about the existing statute that says benefits paid or payable under 47, 45, 301 to 309? Do you know what those reference?
I believe Amanda does.
Ms. Hulbert?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interject myself, but I had the same question just a few minutes ago. We looked them up. It looked like the cash assistance payments to Alaskan senior citizens.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. And then you touched on the fact that currently under federal law, retirement plans, 401ks, that type of thing, they're already settled and there's no upper limit. And no state has passed this type of legislation with an upper limit. Because, in fact, if people don't have access to those retirement plans, they can use this as a component of retirement planning. Is that correct?
That is correct. What happens is lots of Alaskans own small businesses. And the cost of managing a 401k with all the federal requirements is substantial. The other thing, too, is a lot of employers are stopping their contributions to 401ks. The trend today is for less and less opportunity for retirement planning, especially for people in smaller businesses. And so by allowing this to be used in this fashion, we can offer the same protections for Alaskans and small business people to plan. And so that's one of the reasons why we brought this through now. If you look at the number of employers who stopped their employee match to contribution plans or have even stopped offering retirement plans, that's why we want to get some mechanisms for small business people to begin to plan for themselves and for their families.
Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Hulbert? I don't see any. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Thank you for the opportunity. As you can tell, this is really important to me.
You're quite welcome. Dennis Bailey is on the line to answer questions. Mr. Bailey, are you there?
I am.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bailey, legal questions. Maybe, Mr. Bailey, you can answer this question about Ms. Hulbert, or maybe it was Ms. Mortensen, actually, I think, pointed out that if there had been a collateral assignment in the debt instrument, then there was an ability to collect from the annuity contract or the unmatured life insurance, given that express statement in the debt instrument. Absent that, say a less sophisticated person who did not so state in the debt instrument, would they be without a remedy?
I don't think you can, through the chair or Mr. Chairperson, this isn't a question of whether they'd have a remedy or not, but they would not be able to collect against annuity contracts.
Thank you. I appreciate your clarifying that. That was just my question. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Bailey? I'm sorry, did I cut you off, sir?
I had one other comment that I wanted to correct, and that was that you were looking at the list of exemptions in Section 015 and noting that those were fairly nominal amounts.
Yes.
There are other items that are exempt under the exemption statute as well, and the Alaska statute provides specifically for exemptions for retirement plans as well. It also exempts items.
Mr. Bailey, I don't mean to interrupt you, but is that in like sub? Is there a B subsection to 0938015?
Actually, they're separately listed. For the exemption for retirement plans is under 938017. There is also an exemption for homestead. There's a certain amount that you're qualified to exempt for your home. Those are examples that come to mind right off.
I see. So it's fair to say that there exists now on the statutes, it'd be hard to quantify it as to whether it's liberal or not liberal, but there are categories of exemptions, including a homestead, a 401k, and then the ones that we have here in front of us.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Bailey? Hearing and seeing none, is there anyone else on the line who'd like to testify about HB 101? Anyone else here in the room would like to testify? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. And I have continuing questions about how this is going to work out, and the press of time is going to require me to set the bill aside. So thank you so much for coming here today. And with that, we will turn to now, next on the list is HB 129, power to revoke real estate licenses. Brought to us from my counterpart in the House, Representative Ramirez. Welcome. Is this your first appearance in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee of the hearing this year?
Yes, this year.
Well, then I wish we'd baked cookies, because you're always so gracious and welcoming to us when we come on down to your chamber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have an imaginary cookie.
And enjoy it.
Mr. Chair, I don't think you could be any more gracious. This is Representative Jay Ramirez, District 10. This is a very complicated bill, so I brought Margaret Dowling to explain the details, and it was just such a privilege to come before your committee. I wanted to escort her down here so I could back her up.
Excellent.
So, excuse me.
Further questions for the bill sponsor? I don't
so
see
many.
Any. I don't
so
see
things.
Any, but
well done,
we'll just have to let
well
that
done,
go.
Mr. Chairman.
We'll just have to let that go. Thank you, Representative Ramirez. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear from you.
For the record, my name is Margaret Dowling. I, as you know, I'm staff to Representative Ramirez. I'll try to keep my comments brief on this very complicated bill. House Bill 129 makes, I have to admit, very simple but needed correction to existing law. Under the existing law, the Alaska Real Estate Commission must revoke the license of a real estate broker or associate broker if that person has been convicted of forgery, theft, extortion, conspiracy to defraud creditors, or fraud.
Oh,
that's
touche, touche.
That's great.
And well done. And since we don't have the cameras here, let the record reflect that Senator Terry was brought
very nice.
Representative Ramirez a cookie.
See how nice we are in our body.
That's great. This is a wonderful. I'm so happy to be here. All right. So as I was saying before, pleasantly interrupted, current law allows the Real Estate Commission to revoke a license of a broker or an associate broker for crimes such as forgery, theft, extortion, conspiracy to defraud creditors, or fraud. They can also refuse to grant a license or deny renewal of a license on the same grounds. Unfortunately, the law does not apply to real estate salespeople. And in, as of November 2008 in Alaska, there were 1,400 real estate salespeople licensed, and compared to only 411 associate brokers and 483 brokers. So real estate is a field where customers place their faith in their agent's trustworthiness. They have unfettered access to buyers and sellers' homes, and they often assist clients with sometimes complicated negotiations and financial transactions. With over 1,400 real estate salespeople licensed in Alaska, the need for this bill is clear. HB 129 empowers the Real Estate Commission to appropriately regulate their profession, including revoking, refusing to grant, or denying renewal of a salesperson license, and it protects the public. That's all I really have to say about the bill. I do have Gail Horetsky, who's an AG in the Civil Division in the Commercial and Fair Business section, who assists boards and commissions. She's here to answer questions. We also have, I believe, online Sharon Walsh, who's willing to answer questions on behalf of the Real Estate Commission.
I see them both signed up, and thank you, Ms. Dowling. Let me just say a couple of remarks, and I'll see if other members have questions. First, I thank you for bringing this bill, because on page 2, line 14, I see the use of the word connives at, which doesn't have anything to do with your bill, but it's just phrase that struck me as being a little bit out of the ordinary. It's not something you see in the statutes much. It looks like a throwback to an earlier time, and it delighted me. So there's that. Probably this is also a good time for me to put on the record that my wife is a real estate licensee, but she has never in the time that I've known her or ever before, to my knowledge, ever committed a felony. So I don't think there's going to be any problem there. She's just not the felonious type.
Does she ever connive?
Yeah, she connive.
Well, ooh. I'm gonna duck that question and move on down the line. I did think the only thing that crossed my mind, and it doesn't really pertain exactly to this bill, but I just thought it was worth tossing out there. I thought we had gone to great lengths in the recent past to rename real estate agents, yeah, brokers, and salespersons as licensees. And I see that pertains to a different segment of the real estate statutes, but if you can at least enlighten me, I'd appreciate it.
All I can tell you is that under this section, they are referred to as salespersons and brokers and associate brokers. And I know commonly in Alaska, they refer to themselves as licensees, but under this section, that's how they're named. And so that's how we're using it today.
Were the hour not so late or the day not so long, we might try to take a crack at making everything uniform, but this is probably not, probably wouldn't be fair to everyone involved. Senator Terrio.
On the applicability section, it will apply to offenses that occur before, on, or after. Quite often, you know, we make it very clear that it's on or after, so it's prospective. And so I just wonder about that before.
Speak to that. That really, what that does is clarify the intent of this change. And the intent is that if a salesperson was convicted of a felony, say, the day before the effective date of this bill, then that person could have their license revoked, or if they applied for renewal, it could be denied. So it shows the intent is to protect, again, the public and people who have been convicted of felons. Felonies and affects public interest. So it enhances the regulatory scheme so the Real Estate Commission can adequately police their own profession.
So
follow up.
But if somebody is getting relicensed or re-upped and they had a felony conviction 10 years ago, is it going to impact
them? Sure, Senator Terrio. Under the existing statute, the way it's set up, if you're convicted of a felony, then you have 7 years from the date of your completion of your sentence that you are barred from a license.
Okay.
So it would be after that 7-year period you could reapply for your license and be granted that.
Follow up?
So if it was right. 10 years ago, but they've done their 7 years, they're going to be able to continue.
Chair, Senator Terrio, that's correct.
Okay.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And Margaret, have you looked into the constitutionality of that? Because my recollection is that you can put terms like this on or after the effective date, but you can't reach back in to prior criminal acts.
Right. Through the chair, Senator McGuire, Gail Horetsky, again, she's here to answer questions, and I'll defer that to her. And that's dealing with ex post facto
exactly.
laws, and basically I'll just take a stab at it initially that under that provision, it's our view that this does not add to any additional punishment for the crime. What this does is it sets up a regulatory scheme which already exists. It enhances it so that the state interest in protecting the public can be met. And again, you're talking about salespeople who have unfettered access to people's homes. They assist in sometimes complicated transactions. And this is a way for the state to protect the public from people who, in a profession where the public is assuming the person they're dealing with will be trustworthy. And it doesn't enhance or increase any punishment to the person whose license is being denied or revoked.
Criminal punishment.
Correct.
Right, right. I think that's probably the distinction there that Ms. Horetsky may want to make for us. But Ms. Walsh, do you want to chime in?
My name is Gail Horetsky.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I got mixed up.
I'm with AG's office.
I had you. Okay. Please, please, please. You are welcome. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here to answer questions on HB 129. It does make a relatively minor change in existing law. As Ms. Dowling indicated, right now, brokers and associate brokers are under these provisions, and this adds salesperson to the existing law. And the existing law does provide that if a person is convicted of certain offenses, the real estate commission shall revoke their license. So you have to have a revoked license, or this doesn't even apply. So that's the first step.
Sorry, could you say, I was distracted just for a second. Could you say that again?
Sure.
Just so thank you.
This doesn't apply in and of itself to convictions. It applies to people whose licenses have been revoked because of the conviction. So if you look on page 3, Mr. Chairman, on paragraph 10, which is the operative language there, it says the commission shall revoke the license of a broker who has been convicted of a felony or other crime. So you have to have the step of, you have the criminal conviction, then the commission has to move forward and actually file an accusation and revoke the license. That's a separate step, revocation of the license. Once the license is revoked, based on the conviction, then the person can't get relicensed until 7 years after they finished serving the sentence on the underlying conviction.
Sure, but I think what Senator Terrio is after, or at least I know what I'm after now, I'll just ask my own question, and that is someone's convicted 5 years ago of a felony DWI. They got out of jail, got a license. They're practicing real estate now in the state of Alaska. Would this bill allow the commission to revoke the license?
Well, if you're talking about felony DWI, only if, and this is on line 20, in the judgment of the commission, it affected the ability of that person to practice.
Very good. Okay, so that's interesting. That would be up to, it would depend on maybe the nature of the crime or what sort. Let's make it a little more blunt. Let's say they've been convicted of embezzlement, 5 years ago.
Well, and then again, yes, sir. Continuing on, Mr. Chairman, or if the person has been convicted of felony theft, extortion, conspiracy to defraud creditors, or fraud. So, what did you ask?
I said embezzlement. We'll just go ahead and let's say
theft.
Let's say theft,
yeah.
Right? So absolutely yes if theft.
Felony
theft, or perhaps if it's a different felony, depending on the circumstances. But there is something of an ex post facto issue. That is, it's a conviction from the past that you're being repenalized for. But since it's not a criminal penalty, at least that would be my analysis, is that it's not an issue. No one's going back to jail.
I guess from our point of view, speaking from a legal point of view, this is not a penalty issue at all. A person doesn't have a constitutional right to a license. If he or she meets the license criteria and they get a license, they then have a property interest in it, certainly.
Right.
But they're not entitled to have a license unless they meet the criteria. Same thing for
a person who's making a nice living as a real estate agent might view that differently if their ability to do so is.
It's admitted that they have a property interest in the license, obviously, but
right.
The
I'm agreeing with you. I'm just right. Articulating a few of the parameters.
The whole purpose of licensing profession is that you set a minimum standard below which the public can be confident that the person hasn't fallen. You can't guarantee he's going to be a good agent or a bad doctor or whatever it is. But if a person doesn't meet the minimum criteria for either initial licensure or renewal every 2 years as these come up, he or she is not entitled to hold that license. And so this is not a punishment issue. It's a licensure is a continuing status, and you can, if you fall out of eligibility, you fall out of your status as of holding the license because you no longer meet the licensure criteria. And it's a public safety, protect the public regulatory measure, not penalizing of the person who's already got a criminal conviction before.
It's a wonderful answer. Thank you. Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and through the chair, you can take a stab at it, but I would suspect that it's the kind of thing that's ripe for litigation because, I mean, we can argue about nuances of what's a penalty or not, but somebody's professional license and the revoking of that is certainly a penalty. It may not be criminal in nature, but it's certainly economic in nature. And this is one of the things we dealt with when you talked about sex offenders and the registry. So we wanted to reach back and grab all of the individuals in this state who had been prior sex offenders and put them into a registry. And we knew that putting them into a registry was not a criminal procedure, if you will. It was a civil procedure. It was a registration mechanism. And yet the court came back and said, absolutely not. Forward-looking, you can ask that of people who on the day of that enactment or in the future are convicted, but it is a violation of it's an ex post facto problem to try to reach back. And I don't know, but if it's the case that the underlying statute as it applies to brokers has that kind of language in it, I'd be curious to know if anything has come before the commission upon the enactment of that. I mean, because you could just envision today, let's say we pass this out, goes to the floor and is signed into law, there are likely individuals that are salespeople in this state, I don't know who they are, but as the chairman said, that may have DUI felonies or whatever felonies they have that are going to have their real estate license revoked. It's a risk, I guess, the bill sponsor takes.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond to that?
Yes, please.
I think that exact reason is the purpose for the language in the bill that makes it clear that it is, in fact, intended to apply to convictions that occurred before the effective date of the bill. Because, as you know, under our state law, the idea that something is retroactively or retrospectively applied does not make it unconstitutional.
Sure.
But there is a state statute that says if that intent is intended, that it should be explicitly stated. So it's an attempt to minimize the legal issues on appeal, or if it's challenged, that language clarifying the legislature's intent was added. And we're really glad that language is in there because it does clarify the scope and make and also comply with the statute that requires the retrospective effect to be specifically stated in the bill. We have had this come up before in other circumstances, like, for example, driver's licenses and also other situations where the licensure criteria for a particular profession has been upgraded, like a degree requirement added or some other narrowing of the criteria. And people do drop out. There is an effect to it. And people have said, wait, you know, I had an interest in making my living that way. And the courts, by and large, have said, as long as it's a rational requirement that's related to the profession, the operation of the profession, that yes, of course, the legislature can change the eligibility criteria for regulated professions. Otherwise, the standards would never rise over the years. I mean, people would say, well, I was backgrounded in 1970 level, and you can't apply those new requirements. And to me, whether they're CE or education or whatever, in our courts, and in fact, nationwide, the courts have not held that. They've said, hey, it's a continuing status licensure. If you comply with requirements, you keep your license. If you don't, then you don't.
Senator McGuire.
And through the chair, last point, that makes sense, but we're not talking here in this case about raising up additional CLEs or professional requirements. Rather, we are reaching back into somebody's criminal record. And that's the part that I'm talking about, is the fact that we treat criminal penalties and criminal offenses differently than civil. So we say that once you've sort of done your time, you've done it. And if you're going to add additional burdens or considerations of someone's criminal past, that's what I'm saying is the trigger. The fact that you might come back and say, we'd like people to have additional hours of continuing education in the area of real estate law and so forth and so on, absolutely. But this is different. This is because you're referencing someone's criminal act.
Let me just jump in.
Respectfully, I don't think it is different. I think that you're reading
Let me jump in just for a second. Thank you. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And I guess, but Senator McGuire has a point, and it's a good point. It's that economic pain is real, and people may lose their jobs. But I guess I would pose this, as I was sitting here listening to the debate, it's a fascinating debate, but we are a little short on time. I guess I would pose this little thought experiment, and that's this. Imagine you had a state that employed teachers, and the only requirement you had to be a teacher was that you had a high school education and a degree from college. And assume that that went along for 20 years, and suddenly you realize you had 50 sex offenders teaching in your schools, and you decided to change the requirement to be a teacher to say you've got to have a high school education, a degree from college, and you can't be a sex offender. The effect of that bill would be to strip the teaching certificates of all those sex offenders you had in your schools. I think we'd all be jumping onto that bill as fast as we possibly could, signing off on it and passing it, and putting those sex offenders out of work. And they might come to us and say, hey, you're taking away my job. And we'd say, tough luck. We've raised the bar. And I think that's somewhat analogous to the situation here.
And it may work, but they may sue.
Let them.
Yeah.
So, any more questions for Ms. Horetsky? Ms. Walsh, I have a question for you. Thanks so much. I have a question for you if you're on the line.
I am.
Do you have any, let me put it two ways. First question, do you ask for criminal histories of the individuals that come before you as they seek a real estate salesperson's license, broker license, and so forth?
We don't. We just have a self-disclosure form that they fill out. So we don't do fingerprinting. We just simply ask, have you ever been convicted? They either mark yes or no.
And thanks for that. Next question and last one from me. Do you have any reason to believe that this bill will apply to any of the licensees that are currently working in the state? And by apply, I mean retroactively apply to people that have licenses and that have felony, disqualifying felony convictions.
I only know of one case right now.
Further questions? Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe, through the chair, Jay Ramirez again. I believe the one case she's referring to is
the reason for the bill
that precipitated them contacting us for this clarification so that they may police their own. And I don't want to lose sight of the intent of the bill, which was to give them the authority in a profession, as you know, Mr. Chair, thrives on trust, and the fact that they had lost the ability to self-police when one of their own had lost their rights in society but was still able to practice real estate. Sometimes it's good just to come back to the intent.
Ground level.
And what a pleasure it has been to interface with your committee. I would say, depending on what the chair decides, it's been a delight.
Gee, I was just about to make a decision, but thank you for that. Senator Wilkowski, do you want to jump in?
No, I was just wondering if he needed some milk for his coffee.
And a bib.
Anyone else online who wants to testify on behalf of HB 129? Anyone else here in the room who wants to testify? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Senator McGuire has raised some excellent points. I am comfortable with the state of the bill, and so with that, I would solicit a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move House Bill number 129 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes out of the Judiciary Committee.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. Take a short at ease. let's go back on the record. We are back on the record. We've got a long bill and a short bill. We're going to take a stab at the short bill. HB 201 is here, and so is the prime sponsor, Representative Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and you know what to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Craig Johnson, Representative District 28, and I know you've heard many, many times that this is a simple bill, but this truly is a simple bill, and I don't say that lightly. Like most of my brilliant legislation, it comes from a constituent who called up and said that he would like to have notification from public safety when his concealed carry permit expires. It's something that sits around, you don't use a lot, and all of a sudden you're 90 days late, and you could spend a considerable amount of money retesting and requalifying everything. So we wanted the department to send out notification. I'm of the belief that if you have a carry concealed permit, you ought to have a little bit of responsibility. So kind of met in the middle and said that we will attempt to make your carry concealed permit expire on your birthday. So it'll be the same time as your driver's license every 5 years. There's a period of adjustment in there where it could be 4, but not more than 5, so that everything catches up. And basically, in a nutshell, that's what this bill does. The questions we've had is, why do we even need it? Because Alaska doesn't have a carry concealed permit, but 34 other states has reciprocity with the state of Alaska. And just because you can do it here legally doesn't mean you can go there unless you've gone through the training and have the carry concealed permit. So very simply, this bill makes your carry concealed permit expire on your birthday.
Good, succinct presentation. Thank you, Representative Johnson. A question from Senator Lilikowski.
I'm trying to do the math in my head, but like Senator French said earlier on, there, my math isn't working as well. It's late in this session, but could you have a situation where it could be less than 5 years someone would have their permit?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it can be 4, and it's in the bill that it can be 4, but not more than 5. So there is a point, and I suppose if someone wanted to say, no, I don't want to do that, I want the full 5, I think people will jump on this because of the simplicity of doing it.
Sort of a fielder's choice there for the holder of the permit?
I would think that they would have that opportunity. And there's someone from the department. That might be too complicated, and they may not have a choice, but, you know, it's... I think it would be to simplify things. Who wouldn't jump on that?
Okay. We've got two representatives from the Department of Public Safety on the line. But before we turn to them, any other questions for the bill's sponsor? Don't see any. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Kathy Monfreda and Kelly Howell. Nice to have you both on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'll turn to either one of you that wants to take a crack at Senator Wilikowski's question about whether there is any sort of option, or whether you read the statute as saying, you know, the permit must expire on the person's birthday. And whoever chooses to answer, just identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name's Kathy Monfreda. I'm the chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety, and part of my duties are oversight of the Concealed Handgun Permit Program. We read that... Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that it must expire on the birthday. We wouldn't be giving permit holders a choice.
So I was. There is no fielder's choice. It's going to be your birthday or no day.
That's our reading of it. As written.
I think clarity is a good thing. Other questions for Ms. Monfreda? I'm sorry. 4 questions.
No. Mr. Chairman, and I might have misunderstood his question, whether it expires in 4 or 5 years.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to, you know, automatically. So if I misunderstood, it will expire on your birthday. But 4 or 5, you don't have an option on that if it depends on where it falls. So I apologize if I misunderstood your question.
Very good. Further questions for either the bill sponsor or Ms. Monfreda? I don't hear or see any. Ms. Monfreda, while we've got you on the line, I just want to say that a long, long time ago when I was a DA, the toughest and I thought smartest DA in that office was a guy named Jay Fayette, and he spoke of you in glowing terms every time your name came up, and that was even then a long time ago, but I just appreciate your long service to the public and the important job you do. Senator Wilkowski. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. What is the cost for to renew the permit? Do you know that?
$25.
So there's not going to be a big outcry if someone kind of gets in a cycle where it would be they only got it for, say, 4.5 years, and then they had, you know, it's
the way we're looking at it is it would be 4 years and however many months, you know, till their birthday and their next birthday.
Okay,
So it could be 4 years and 1 month, or 4 years and 11 months, you know, depending on when they apply.
That was the variability, was to get it set on that birthday.
So it would only be on the first renewal or the first time they get the permit issued. After that, renewals would be 5 years.
Got it. Further questions? That was a nice clarification. Don't hear or see any. Anyone else in the room who'd like to testify on HB 201? Anyone else online who'd like to testify on House Bill 201? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close public testimony and ask the will of the committee. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, this is a relatively simple bill, and I think we can move it out of committee today. I'd make a motion that we move CS for House Bill number 201 out of committee along with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. Congratulations, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee.
Short at ease.
Thank you.
Back on the record, it's 2:30. The Judiciary Committee continues to roll on, and we are now on House Bill 102. We have the prime sponsor here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Groomberg. This may be your first bill here in front of the committee this year. Is that right?
Probably my last, too.
Well, given that we're going to close up business in 30 minutes, that may be true. So with that, I will turn to you and let you give us an overview of the bill, and I see you've got an expert witness with you as well.
Yes, I do. First of all, I'd like to introduce Terry Thurbin, as well as being the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the state, as Senator Theriault well knows. She's not here in that capacity today. She is one of Alaska's commissioners on uniform state laws, and she is really the person who will answer the questions, and I'm just going to make the introduction, and when the bell rings, if you don't need me, I'll disappear. To the unnamed other side. This is a bill that is brought to us at the request and suggestion of the Alaska members of the Commission on Uniform State Laws. It updates Chapter 1, Title 1 and Title 7 of the UCC. Title 1, as I think most of you know, is the general title that applies throughout the code. It has definitions and policies and things like that. Title 7, as probably most of you and myself didn't know, is the warehouseman's section and bills of lading. And it's extremely important to the people who are in the moving business and the storage business. And what this does is it makes a number of technical changes that bring Alaska into line with over 30 states nationwide. And as I think most of you know, the uniform laws are drafted and revised by the commissioners, who are several hundred people from around the country, law professors and top attorneys and judges and members of the attorneys general staff. And then they pass them in a floor session. They meet several times a year. And they must be approved by the ABA House of Delegates. So they're thoroughly vetted. And every few years, they go through these commercial codes and this sort of thing to make sure that they keep up with technology. And that's what this has done. And as a matter of fact, in one fairly obscure portion, a section later in the bill, we caught something that nobody else had brought to anybody's attention because of a new federal law. And so we are in the first line on that particular section, which if you're really interested, I can find, but just
oh, please. Please, Representative Groomberg.
And aside from that, we did a couple of other things at my request with the bill that don't deal directly with the UCC. But there's a provision in Title I that requires in all UCC dealings, there be a duty of good faith and fair dealing. And there are a number of Alaska Supreme Court cases that require that in all instances of the execution and performance of contracts.
It applies to any commercial contract.
Yes, and leases and things like that, too. And so we've codified that. So people will be able to find that. And that's the first section in the bill, section one of the bill, on page one. And then in title 34.35, the lien statutes. There's the attorney's lien, and there are all kinds of lien statutes. But there's an old statute that deals with warehouse. And it talks about people storing oats and grains and cattle and things like that. Because we have Title VII in the UCC amendments, we thought we would bring that up to date, too, and cross-reference them. And so those are the only provisions, and those are the provisions in Title 34.35. And then starting on page 3 of the bill, Section 8, we do the uniform law update. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Thurbin, I'll just sit back and ask to be excused appropriately.
Before we do that, questions for the sponsor.
I just want to thank
from your senator.
I just want to thank Representative Grunberg. I know this is, I don't think anyone really enjoys Uniform Commercial Code. I know, I speak for myself anyway.
Yeah.
But it is important, and it does really require attention to detail. And I know that's something that you certainly have a reputation for, and I appreciate you doing this, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, and it's really nice to bring forth a bill. You asked, I think Chairman did, if there's any opposition to a previous bill. And Terry, and this is Allison Lafine, who's, by the way, my staff, my legislative assistant, who in a week will be going and becoming staff to the Congress of Micronesia.
Oh, wow.
Congratulations. Is it warm there?
She's been heavily involved. She came to us originally from clerking for the Superior Court, the District Court in Minnesota, and got high accolades there, and she's been working on this thing. I'm not aware, and these people can correct me if I'm wrong, of any opposition from anybody, and we have vetted it through the Bar Association Business Law Section, specifically the folks who represent warehousemen, and as I understand it, there's no opposition. I'm right on that. Okay, thank you.
Let me just quickly ask you one question, Representative Grunberg, and then we'll let you go and turn to Ms. Thurbin. In the Section 1, you have the good faith provision. I think that's fantastic to make it explicit. I just remember pounding into my brain during the summer that I was studying for the bar that it had to be the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. But it looks as though you've recast that as saying have a duty to act fairly and in good faith. Do you think those are the same? Are they equivalent?
Absolutely. And this was, I thought, and I worked on this with Teresa Bannister. We crafted that carefully. It's exactly the same, and it's, I think, more modern.
Very good. Further questions for the representative? Don't see any. Thanks again for making time for us. Yes, very good. Ms. Thurbin, welcome to the committee. You know the drill. Please put yourself on the record. And if you have general remarks, we'd be happy to have them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Terry Thurbin. I'm one of Alaska's delegation of commissioners to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which these days we're calling the Uniform Law Commission for short, and that was one of the many great improvements they've made. And this UCC update is yet another, or a set of others. First of all, I should thank Ms. Lafine and Representative Grunberg for the hard work they've done on this bill this year. This was our delegation's legislative priority for the very simple reason that it is time that we brought our Uniform Commercial Code up to speed with where the other states have come down. On the warehouse provisions, for example, those amendments have been available since, I think, 2003. The general provisions in Article 1 have been available since 2001, and respectively, the Article 1 provisions have been already adopted in 35 states, and in addition to ourselves, there are three other states with introductions this year. For the warehousing provisions, it's 32 states adopted, and ourselves and three others for adoption this year. So we're getting toward truly having uniformity with these updates. We already have uniformity as far as all of the states having some version or other of the various titles of the Uniform Commercial Code. And I know you've heard today a lot of people say their bills are very simple. Well, I won't pretend this one appears simple because it's really long, but it is fairly simple in the sense that the substantive provisions that it changes are relatively few. Of the 60 some odd pages we have here, an awful lot of it is terminology, updating terminology, making conforming changes to fit with a handful of substantive changes. The UCC provisions start with, I think, Section 8, and that's what I'm speaking to today, only to the UCC provisions, not to the other sections that Representative Groomberg just described for you. But those provisions, apart from the modernization of the warehousing, the shipping and storage trade that Representative Groomberg already described, which is attributable to Article 7 of the UCC, we have a handful of changes in Article 1 that address just
no, few. No, when you say Article 1, do you mean beginning in Section 8?
Article 1 of the Uniform Commercial Code.
Very good. So not section, but article.
Article of, I'm using the vernacular, I apologize, I'm using the vernacular of the conference now. But let me just call those the general provisions and the other the warehouse provisions. I think Representative Groomberg has done a great job of already describing what the warehouse provisions do. What I would give you a little highlight of is how few substantive changes really there are embraced in the general provisions. What the conference found and the committee that was set to update the provisions, the general provisions, they found a handful of problems that had not been discovered up until people had tried to live with the general provisions, in part because the other articles of the Uniform Commercial Code, the ones that deal with secured transactions and leases and sales and that, over time those had evolved and the general provisions just hadn't been kept up to date. When they sat about updating the general provisions, they came up with really only what I identified as five or six areas where they needed to make substantive change. One was as simple as to clarify the scope of the applicability of these general provisions to make it clear that they're only applying to Uniform Commercial Code covered transactions. Previously there had been a provision, a statute of frauds provision, which most of you probably know that deals with when you have to have an agreement in writing in order for it to be enforceable. The way that the provision had existed before it seemed to reach beyond the Uniform Commercial Code covered transactions and be a general statute of frauds. They clean that up. That's the kind of things that this revision does. It also clarified or made a better selection, if you will, on the choice of laws. Previously, the only choice of laws that folks could make for which law applies to govern their transactions had to have some connection to the parties. Now the updates will allow the parties sort of free contract. They can choose any state law or, in the case of international transactions, any jurisdiction's law to govern with a couple of protective exceptions to protect consumers and some other public policy-oriented protections that will allow people, individual human being consumers, to be able to use their own state laws where appropriate. But as to the sophisticated folks out there who want to enter into a commercial transaction, they can designate any law as the governing law. And that was one of the improvements. As Representative Groomberg mentioned, there's a good faith provision in the UCC, and it was updated to define good faith as honesty in fact and the observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealings. So just to track a little bit more with what they'd done with the good faith concept and some of the other provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code. Those are kind of the highlights of the substantive changes that were made in the general provisions. The warehousing sections, as we've already discussed, it's to bring us into the modern age, especially electronic commerce, using electronic documents of title and evidence of ownership in the transfer of title. Which is something that is widely supported by the warehousing and transportation sectors, including folks like Federal Express and that are already using electronic documents of title, if you will, and the law in some of the states just haven't caught up with that yet. So that's it in a nutshell. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. If you have any, we normally have one of the national experts, a person who was involved in the drafting, available by teleconference, but we weren't able to arrange that today. But I'd be happy to take a crack. I've heard him answer a few questions, and
Thank you. Yesterday we had the revisers bill, and this is somewhat similar. You get an enormous bill. It's full of technical language, and at some level you sort of have to trust the experts that have gone before you and who vetted it. But one of the remarks I made today on the floor about the revisers bill is that I like to conduct what I call an acid test, and that is I sort of open up a page, I bear down the language there, I'll ask a couple questions about that, if it stands up, you know, I sort of at least get the feeling that, you know, that there's a few segments of the bill that have been closely examined. Because I do trust you, I trust Representative Groomberg, and I trust the experts who brought this to bill, but we still have our own sort of duties, I guess, of due diligence. So my little inquiry is narrow, it's focused, and it's on page 28. I have two of these. Page 28, line 19, and this may be a question that Mr. Representative Groomberg wants to answer, but I see this is the section is 33. It's liability for non-receipt or misdescription, and as I read it, it actually, and I'm in sub 1, which probably, well, I hate to sound like an expert, but it's not the most clearly phrased language I've ever come across, and my question is specifically of the use of the word or, beginning of line 19, where you've struck of. And I just want to make sure that you agree that that's the right substitution.
Well, I see, Mr. Chairman, I do see your concern. Bear with me for a second while I read it and see if I can make sense of this.
Representative Groomberg. That's weird. I love it when you say that. You know, actually, I first I thought it was, and then after I read it twice, I decided it wasn't. But I wanted to get your view of that. If you come over to the microphone, Representative Groomberg.
I don't really want to say anything else. I shouldn't be the pipe. This is Max Groomberg. I said that's weird.
I can see why it said of, because it seems to be the labels of kind, quantity, or condition, but it's actually a series of things. It's in terms of marks or labels, marks of kind, that is, what kind is it, marks of quantity, there's 30 of them, marks of condition, marks of receipt. I think that's the way it's actually constructed grammatically. Representative Groomberg.
Mr. Chair.
You got to get closer to the microphone.
If you really have a question, may I just confirm you? We get Terry Bannister.
Certainly.
We've got a few minutes.
That may be something Ms. Bannister, if we get her on the line, would have a technical answer on that. I don't know if that's something that was just.
It's not. I'm not possessed of it. I just, you know, I just thought, you know, we just need to check if we've got a minute.
I didn't see that.
Mr. Chairman, well, if we're going to try to do that, that's fine. But as I read it, I can make sense out of it with the substitution, and without going back and looking at the original and the drafting comments that the conference put together, I can imagine that they were perhaps trying to characterize kind, quantity, or condition as something that would be a description in and of itself on the packaging, for example. Or on the document of title, if that's what we're talking about, the receipt, and that it be an intentional
in terms of marks.
Correction, whereas of may have been viewed as having been the typographical error that the conference first introduced.
Right. The description is in terms of marks. The description is in terms of labels. The description is in terms of kind, quantity, condition, so forth.
Yes.
Right.
So I think perhaps, although I understand.
No, I agree with you. I hesitated on it. I thought, oh, that's I got one. And then as I really thought about it, I decided that I didn't.
So have we passed our acid test?
Acid test. Just and one other, and this is on page 51. For some reason, the greater minds have decided to strike the word "the" and have it read a subsequent lessee in ordinary course of business. And I don't see that it changes the meaning, but I object just in general.
Mr. Chair, I raised this issue when we vetted the bill on this particular section. I said, in Alaska, the term is in the ordinary course of business. And I think there may have been, yes, it's down on line 23 also.
Mm-hmm. There's several of them on that page.
Yeah,
right.
And I was told that the way they drafted the Uniform Act eliminated the word "the," and I wasn't going to make a case out of it, so I passed on to newer and better things. But I did miss the "or" previously.
Well, I'm awfully proud of myself.
Yes,
you're really making the chairman happy. Senator Wilikowski.
Page two. Looks like, I'm wondering if it's a little bit of a policy change here. We're changing livestock to animals. And I'm just wondering, we're currently allowing liens for people who feed or pasture horses, cattle, hogs, sheep, and other livestock, and we're changing that to animals, which I would imagine include dogs and cats. And so I'm wondering if, I guess there's a little bit of a policy change there. People's pets are now potentially subject to lien. Is that something that was discussed at all, or is it a conscious change?
Well, it certainly was considered by me when we talked about modernizing the statute, and Ms. Thurbin wasn't particularly involved in these things. Ms. Lapine was, and it was my thought that we should make it apply to any animals, because particularly in urban areas, not many of us have livestock, but a lot of us have pugs and larger animals. Pugly would appreciate this.
Okay. Thank you.
We've got a few more minutes, and so I'll ask, what do you do with a lien on a dog?
Well,
I mean, because I can see how it comes up. You take your animal into a boarding kennel, and they can cost a lot of money. I suppose does the lien really get put on the dog, do you think, Representative Grunberg, or on your checking account?
The lien is a possessory lien.
So and the most you get out of it, the most the kennel gets out of the action is to possession of the Labrador? Or
well, then they, through the chair, you're the chair. They would be able to sell the animal. And you can see on line 11 of page 3, they can additionally, if they are not paid, and this is in the existing statute, get the value of the property and 50% additional as a value. And then later in the UCC, it talks about getting any damages which would be incidental and consequential. And we've cross-referenced in section 7, and later in the UCC in article 7, we have made it clear that these are in addition cumulative to each other, so that you're not limited to one or the other, as has been the past case. But I didn't want there to be any continuing question as to whether they both stood on equal footing.
Further questions for either Representative Grunberg or Ms. Thurbin? I don't hear or see any. Thank you so much. Anyone in the room who'd like to testify on HB 102? Anyone online? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I am satisfied with the bill. Is there a motion?
Well, I just...
Senator Wilikowski.
I guess I'm a little concerned over the change to the section 4 on animals. I'd hate the thought of taking your dog to the kennel and you not being able to, for whatever reason, pay your bill, and then keeping your dog, your beloved animal. That just bothers me.
It's kind of interesting.
What's a kennel owner to do?
Well, I think you can sue in court to get the money, but I don't know that taking someone's dog is or cat is, I think, pretty.
Well, I'll share a short story with you. It's not exactly about a dog, but my wife took her Land Rover into the Land Rover shop, Stepbrothers. And I'll just parenthetically say, when I asked our former judiciary chairman about them after this dispute happened, he said, "Oh, those Stepbrothers." And so even the former chairman of the judiciary committee wasn't willing to stick up for the Stepbrothers. The car was there a week, came back with this $2,000 bill. And we were fairly certain we were being cheated, and we went down and actually, I think I'm going to stop telling the story because it's a very long story, and I'm not sure it really illustrates anything other than you can get into a legitimate dispute with the owner of a store or a kennel or anything else over who has the property, and we took our property home, anyway. So I guess it sort of illustrates your point, which is you can take the dog home and then later on have a dispute
exactly.
In court over the money that's owed.
Yeah.
Senator McGuire.
And through the chair, it seems like a better even analogy would be, you know, if you can't pay your child's, you know, pediatrician bill, I mean, are they going to keep your kid?
Exactly.
Some days you'd want them to, but most days you wouldn't. And it seems
is
like
Baby G an animal?
Baby
no.
G's
I
not.
Say no.
But I think an animal is closer to a human than a car.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. I've got my dogs in the kennel right now, and it's very expensive. And if I went in and suddenly I was charged some exorbitant amount to take my dogs out and I couldn't pay it, I would be furious if they kept my dogs. So I will make, I don't want to hold the bill up, but if it's, I would like to make a conceptual amendment to change the animal care and simply go back to the livestock language in section 4, Mr. Chair.
There is a conceptual amendment, and let's just make certain that we know which sections it applies to. I think it just applies to section 4. Representative Grunberg, do you agree?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Max Grunberg.
And I'll ask you about your opinion of the amendment in a minute, but my first question is
it appears to apply to section 4 on line 16 and 17, and again on line 27 and 28, 29 and 30.
All in section 4.
Right.
Correct? Right.
And I believe that's it.
Section 5 is wool, wheat, oats, and property.
Right.
Section 6 is same.
And Mr. Chair, I think if you wanted to do it on lines 27 and 28, you could just limit it to livestock. I don't think you have to say horses, cattle, hogs, sheep, blah, blah, blah. And I personally don't have any objection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I don't think the House will, since we're dealing with other unnamed animal bills today. I think
jeez.
Not going to that.
Slow down now. Slow down. So the conceptual amendment is to, if you could restate the amendment, Senator Wilkinson.
My conceptual amendment would be to simply revert to the current language on livestock as opposed to animal care. And so on line 16, we would remove the words animal care and go back to livestock. On line 27, we would remove the word animals and retain the words horses, cattle, sheep, hogs, sheep, or other livestock. And then on line 29, we would bring back the upon, take out the animals, put back livestock. Page 30, take out animals, put back livestock.
Line 30, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I understand the amendment. It is conceptual. I think the drafters will understand our gist from the conversation here. Is there objection to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, just to...
Representative Grunberg.
Technically, I would suggest that on lines 28 and 29, we leave the word on rather than upon. That's the normal term. And that we don't have, on set 27 and 28, we don't have to list horses, cattle, hogs, sheep, or other. We can simply say livestock.
That's fine.
Senator Wilkowski, you want to rephrase the amendment to comport with what the suggestion Representative Grunberg just made? You don't have to restate the amendment. You agree that that's...
I agree, and I would
restate my amendment
in the terms as suggested by Representative Grunberg.
Very good. Everyone clear about what the amendment does? Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 1 carries. That brings the bill back before us. Are there further amendments or committee discussion? Hearing and seeing none, I would solicit a motion so that we can get this bill on the drafter and let him tune up the language.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for House Bill number 102 as amended, along with accompanying fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved out of committee. And at 2:55 in the afternoon, we are adjourned.